What are you doing up at this hour of the night?
What are you doing up at this hour of the night?
Prevention of crime. Every hour of the day and night.
Movie.
Break.
Is the team that protects your property and you.
Hello and welcome to the Movie Break podcast. We are on day 5 or day 6 of the Sundance Film Festival.
It's day 6 because you stay 1 week and tomorrow you have to go back home, I think.
Okay, good thinking, yeah. So day 6 of the Sundance Film Festival, last edition in Park City. We are still here. The voice you just heard is Lida's voice.
Hi,
Lida. Hi. And I'm still Patrick. Yeah, as Lida just said, I will leave tomorrow. So I just saw my last film and we will talk about that later. In the meantime, Lida, how are you doing?
I'm super tired. Last night I just slept like maybe 2 or 3 hours because I had to write until late in the early morning hours. And then my first film was at 8:30, and because we have to line up so early for films, that meant being there at 7:30. So getting up around at 6, getting to bed 3 hours earlier, that's tough. So this is now peak tiredness.
And the 8:30 film, was that a public screening or was that a critic screening?
That was a public screening for which I had a reserved ticket. But as we told you, even with a reserved ticket, it makes a lot of sense to line up way early. So I learned my lesson and lined up.
Yeah, I'm asking that also because I realized the press screenings are so much emptier today. At least the screening I just attended was barely half full, I think. So that was nice to see that I could stay a bit longer outside because the sun was on full brightness mode today. And Park City can be really beautiful, even though it's cold. It doesn't feel so cold when the sun is out all day, basically. I don't know if there's something we should say. Like, perhaps we can already have a little summary of the festival so far. Is there, how does it compare to last year's festival with regard to the movies?
Well, the films are still very good and very impressive. So I still must say that the Sundance Film Festival is among all the festivals I visit, one that has the highest quality cut of films. So at no other festival do I give so many top or very good ratings to films as here. Even the films that I don't fully like are more interesting than the ones that you see at many other film festivals. It also feels much higher profile. At almost every public screening there's a Q&A, and we have high level stars here. That's also rare because at some festivals you have interesting films but just nobody comes to present them. So it still feels very high up in my festival ranking, but this kind of naive idealization of the festival that I thought, oh, here it's more tolerant, here it's more liberal, less hierarchies. No, I learned that that's not what it is. So I see it much more realistic.
Yeah, I'm a bit astounded by how little of a political profile this has here. I feel like all the events that are going on are hardly, you know, discussed if I see other people, or even if I think about events that are taking place here. It feels like no one is discussing the elephant in the room, which is the goings on in Minnesota, among other things. Nothing of that, I feel like, really reaches our little festival bubble here. It's rather all about the movies. And I don't know, if we focus on the movies, have you heard anything about titles being acquired by studios? Like last year there was, for instance, the Jennifer Lopez film, right? The Spider-Woman remake that people talked about. Will it be picked up or not? I feel like this year I haven't heard so much about acquisitions.
No, me neither. Even though I have to admit that I also don't have my finger on that issue. So I haven't heard anything, but I think most deals will be closed after the festival. And I know from all my screen and interview requests that a lot of distributors here are holding back on reviews because they want to close deals first before they want any reviews to come in. That usually doesn't say a lot of positive things about the film. If somebody thinks they can show their film because they won't close a deal after they showed it to the critics. But still, no news so far.
Yeah, that being said, I'm pretty sure perhaps the first film I want to talk about today, The Invite, will have a good future. I mean, it should have a good future. So this is the new film by Olivia Wilde. We all might remember this film, Don't Worry Baby, that ended up being a catastrophe just in terms of what kind of how this film was discussed, right? It premiered in Venice, and there was this, I remember there was this video where it seemed like one of the actors was spitting on his co-star. I don't know if you recall that.
Yeah, I remember,
And it was all very awkward. I think it was with Harry Styles, right? He was part of the cast, and it was all, it seemed like they didn't get along very well on set, and I remember it was all a debacle basically. This now seems very different. The Invite is a remake actually by a Spanish film. I think it's called Sentimental, and it makes totally sense because it is such a crowd pleaser. I wonder how many of the jokes and how much of the humor was just taken from that film. I will have to see the original at some point, but it makes totally sense why you would remake that film. It has a great cast. We have Olivia Wilde, who, next to being the director, stars also as one of the lead actors here. She is in a marriage, in a rather unhappy marriage with Seth Rogen. And as if that were all not bad enough, it seems that the Olivia Wilde character has invited the neighbors over. The neighbors who have been very loud recently, and the Seth Rogen character is quite annoyed by that. And
have they been loud making sex?
Exactly, yeah, that's the point. And the Seth Rogen character wants to confront them using this dinner event thing, whatever it is, as an occasion to finally talk straight to them. The neighbors are played by Penelope Cruz, and I wonder if that has to do with the film being originally Spanish, you know, if there are ties. And Edward Norton. And Penelope Cruz is like a sex therapist, so she's very mature in that regard. And Edward Norton as well, he has this long history of growth. You know, the film makes a lot of, I mean, it makes fun of it, but it also takes it seriously. Like, he has matured, and the film plays with Seth Rogen being more like the person that maybe the main audience is channeling or being in line with, and more the child, you know, the man child next to the character played by, now I forgot the name already, the man, the other man.
Edward Norton.
Edward Norton, exactly, yeah. Edward Norton also here has the name Hawk, which is made fun of a lot. And yeah, what can I say? This really plays like a classic studio comedy, maybe from the 80s. It has an incredible, what do you call it? Not tempo, but not speed. What's the word? The jokes have an incredible
timing.
Thank you. The jokes have an incredible timing. The actors do it very well. I think if I have any issue with the film, it really is that I feel like politically it relies too much perhaps on the Seth Rogen perspective, which is more like the heteronormative sort of afraid guy of everything that is not, you know,
conventional
and part of a marriage structure, yeah, tradition. So I think the film really wants us to be aligned with him, and sometimes that just led to situations where I found myself not laughing just because I realize how conventional the jokes are politically. But then again, sometimes I laughed against my, you know, my belief systems and so on. And I think I have to credit the film for that, because that's not so easy to achieve. And yeah, overall, even the film, the way the film ends, it ends rather poignantly and ends bittersweet, as so many of these classics, you know, where there's a couple and they have a fight, but they also, will they find together again? Will they not? That's somewhat in between. And I think the film finds a nice tone for that. And total crowd pleaser. I'm sure this film will do well at the box office as well. So, yeah.
I wonder, is the humor more sarcasm? Is it irony, or is it a darker sense of humor, or a lighter sense of humor?
It is rather light. No, I don't think there's some dark humor, but I will say it gets often a bit uncomfortable to play the joke, basically. Is that, for instance, the Seth Rogen character is remarkably unsympathetic, you know, and he's often, he is sympathetic, but he's not sympathetic toward the other characters sometimes. And I think the film managed that well as well. So he stays likable. And as I said, I think he's the one this all really centers around. At the same time, it doesn't always take the easy way out. But there's a sort of formula that you can at some point see as well with the, where this is all heading. But I think even if you know that, you can still have a good time just with the laughs, which I don't remember a film screening where I've laughed so lot. So that accounts for something, I think. So,
yeah, I still have 2 days until I can see it. Yeah, that was the film where I did not get in. And yeah, I'm super excited to see it. So I'm happy you liked it and I'm really looking forward to it.
Great. And what did you bring us?
Well, yesterday I did see a film that I didn't manage to talk about in our podcast. That is The Only Living Pickpocket in New York. It's directed by Noah Segan and stars John Turturro as the titular pickpocket. And he's like a kind of low-level, old-school gangster. He pickpockets people, like steals small sums of cash, phones that he then cares in with Steve Buscemi as his... yeah, dealer, so to speak, like this guy.
Side gig, as so often, right?
Exactly, yeah, somebody who has like a, this pawn shop, like also an old school pawn shop where you just bring stuff. And yeah, he also has his own history with the police, that like this elderly police officer played by Giancarlo Esposito, who doesn't even really try to arrest him anymore because he knows that this is a small fish who doesn't really do much harm. So this is a film where the police actually do look after the big bad guys and not after the comparatively harmless and benign little guys. And by accident, he steals a USB stick with a lot of Bitcoin on it, really unintentionally, and so gets into a lot of danger. He also cares for his terminally ill wife and is then forced to retrieve this USB stick, which he just threw away because he thought it was just like some gimmick, some merchandise, USB sticks, you know, nobody uses them really anymore. They're given away everywhere. And this film, even though it has a darker undertone and some tragic aspects, it's also very light in humor. And it's basically an acting showcase. We have a lot of great acting here. And the story just like floats by. It's not the deepest emotional film. Like sometimes you really can see, okay, he has this conventional arc. He has a daughter he hasn't seen for years. Like he was an absent father, partly because he was in jail. He had to raise his kids in poverty and all. He's divorced. So you see the conventional mechanisms of the plot occasionally shining through. But there's a lot of... it's very heartwarming in a way that even I couldn't quite resist. So it's a very nice and entertaining film that just has very sympathetic characters. It's basically a character-driven film, really, which is about the dynamics between those people that belong to a brand of people that just stops to exist.
And I find it interesting that you say it's a character-driven story. I mean, I wasn't familiar with the casting, and the three names you named are typically, you know, side characters, right? So
yeah.
It's interesting to see
John Turturro, Steve Buscemi, they're all like often playing very, yeah, remarkable but still minor characters in scripts, and here they really are at the focus of the story. And also Giancarlo Esposito, who does a great job. And this is just a film that shows us also, it has a lot of sympathy for the people on the lowest ends of society, and that's something that I like, because we see so few films about underclass people. That is so rare, and especially that this film also says like there's crime and then there's real crime and real evil people, and real evil people are probably the ones who drive big cars and not necessarily the small-time gangsters who just steal $50 from you. Even though it's annoying. I mean, I had my wallet stolen like most of you probably at some point in your life, but there are also like far, far worse things than that.
And it's interesting that you mentioned the flash drive with the
Bitcoin,
because Bitcoin, you need the password, right? There's
oh,
no
yeah,
way around that.
Oh yeah, but there's a whole plot, there's a whole subplot around the password and everything. And there are a lot of little details, like tricks of the trade and all that, where you can see how old pickpockets do operate and his whole modus operandi. So it's just entertaining to see. And yeah, very nice film that I absolutely can recommend. But also saying that this is like more a Hollywood independent kind of film. It's this kind of glossy independent film that actually could be a studio film, just like The Invite.
Another one that clearly caters to that kind of audience is Chasing Summer. This is the new Josephine Decker film. Josephine Decker became more of an indie darling with Madeline's Madeline. That was maybe 8 years ago or so. And that was a film I really liked. I think I equally liked her next film, Shirley, which played, I think, here in Sundance as well, and then at the Berlinale, about Shirley Jackson with Elizabeth Moss. And say what you will about her, but with these films, at least, you could see a clear signature, right? You could
Absolutely.
Clearly see that's an auteur there working. And this with Chasing Summer, I must say, I haven't seen her last film. I think there was more like a coming of age story that seemed very poppy in a way. So that's probably why I didn't even see that one. I forgot the name at the moment, but yeah, so this is now Chasing Summer, and this is as much a Josephine Decker film as it is an Eliza Schlesinger film. She's a stand-up comedian, and she is not only responsible for the script, she's also the lead actor here. And the story is a story you've heard a million times. It's basically someone in their mid or end 30s who, after a breakup, returns home. And home here is in Texas, that's for sure. And you see a lot of tropes that you know from these kind of films. I think she has a big followership because the audience was screaming the entire time, not only when one of her jokes landed, but also with the side characters, who I assume must be part of her entourage or fellow comics or something that are known to people who follow Schlesinger. And this reminded me a lot of, did you remember that film Trainwreck?
Amy Schumer?
Yeah. It's very much in that kind of vein. I don't want to say that just because these are two blonde women. I really think the way they...
Both are comedians.
Yeah, both comedians. Both, I think, more or less like a debut role in more or less major film. And I felt their kind of humor was very similar. At times, self-deprecating, you know, feminist, but also making fun about the sort of precarity their characters find themselves in. And I have to say, it took me a while to get accustomed to that kind of style and perhaps even register the film's working with, because it's sort of realistic, but it's also not realistic. To give an example, at the beginning, so she, the character, her name is Jamie, she works for relief organizations, so when there are natural catastrophes or something, she steps in with her organization and they help the people on site. And there's an early scene when she shows her colleagues how to swing a hammer to hit some nail on the ground, and the head of the hammer
flies off,
yeah. And this is just the joke, but she wouldn't look back and see what happened here, because we hear in the background a car has probably been broken by that extra something. So you can see it's not really fully realistic, you know, she doesn't care about that and the repercussions. It's more about the comedy out of the moment. But then it tries to also be emotional. She has this 10 years relationship with her sister, and her mom doesn't quite take her seriously. There's this idea also that she always assumed that the people in high school were mean to her for a specific reason that turns out not to be the case, and that she wronged the people instead of the people wronging her at the time. So there's a lot of that going on, and overall I think it has potential to be a crowd pleaser, but I found myself not part of that kind of audience that can appreciate that kind of humor and that kind of tone. There's also, I cannot give that away, I guess, but there is confusion about whom she dates, and she doesn't know who that kind of summer fling is that she is enraptured with. So I cannot really say I will recommend that film to many people. but I think it might find its audience as well, if only for the followership that Eliza Schlesinger brings with her alone. So yeah, Chasing Summer by Josephine Decker.
Yeah, and maybe Josephine Decker's next film will be more in her old indie vein, because sometimes that's just what directors do. They make like one more popular film, more accessible, and then they return to their small, quirky own vein of film.
I will definitely hope so. Yeah, do you have another film?
Oh yeah, that's the one that I just came out of. You know, we are here recording in between screenings, and that is a documentary, like, as we probably already said, the Sundance Film Festival is one of the world's most important documentary film festivals, with two big documentary competitions, one national US documentary and one world documentary competition, and fantastic films. Like, I can just all out recommend everybody to watch any film from any documentary competition or also premiere section here. And this is from a premiere documentary. It's the Brittany Griner story, and as the title says, it's about Brittany Griner, the American basketball star who got arrested in Russia, obviously on completely unfounded charges, like she was busted on drug charges. But what maybe some of you remember, she was taking medical marijuana, and she had in her baggage some empty cartridges which had trace levels of THC oil in them, like less than 1 gram, like really just microscopic amounts. It was obviously that this was not a person who was drug smuggling, but still Russia used this to detain her, and she was almost like nearly 300 days or 200 like 200 something days she was detained in Russia. She went to a gulag, so it was really a nightmare experience being held at the airport and then detained. And this documentary like goes through this whole process and also the public discussions which were associated with it and which popped up. For example, the reasons that led her to even play abroad basketball, because she's like one of the top US players in her field and one of the world's best basketball players, and that she even, despite her huge amount of prowess in the sport, was forced to play abroad to make a living. Which is very interesting, that you think, oh, a high-level sports star, that she would be rich. And no, she's not. She actually had to take those gigs and games abroad to get by and take care of her wife and her family. So the film goes to these aspects, but also goes to the whole negotiation process. Like Biden, maybe also some of you remember that Biden made this kind of prisoner exchange where he got back Britney and he gave in the arms dealer Victor Boat. So Boat is a really, really dark character. He's internationally wanted, so it's not just the US that had him on their list. It's like a lot of, almost every country apart from Russia has him on their list, and he's known as the merchant of death. So a really dark character, and that those two were exchanged. And there was this whole backlash against Brittany Griner because some conservative US citizens felt that other persons who have also been detained in Russia, such as Paul Whedon, should have rather been released than Britney. And of course we know by now that Whedon then sometime later also got freed, but at that point it wasn't clear. So this documentary is very politically conscious, it's really critical, it has a lot of original interviews, archive material from prison everywhere. It's exciting as a thriller and also very emotional, very touching. At the screening we had Brittany Griner and her wife and the director Alexandria Stapleton all present, so it was a very moving and impressive experience, and I can just recommend this documentary throughout. It's exciting, and especially since I think that this high profile case, it got so much media coverage, so a lot of you will remember parts of it, and it's also interesting to see how a story that you followed on the news then gets turned into a documentary.
Yeah, I find this inherently fascinating. I mean, this also really gets at the philosophy of law, right? Because the two of us, we're from Germany, and I remember maybe it was the last year of the Olaf Scholz chancellery, if that's the word, when the US actually wanted that Germany exchanges one of their detainees from Russia so the US can get people back from Russia. So this international negotiation as well, that's not only spanning sometimes two countries,
but sometimes three or more countries.
Yeah, exactly.
Or then also the question like who is worth how much?
That exactly,
sometimes
yeah.
They also try to make deals where one person is against two smaller level prisoners.
Smaller fishes, yeah.
Exactly. So the question like how much is a human life worth? Because if you would look at it from a humanistic perspective, you would say each of them is a person. But also the question like who deserves really to be incarcerated? Like Viktor Bout is evil, yeah. This guy is responsible for the death of hundreds of thousands of people with all the arms deals he did. He's really a total criminal. And Brittany Griner is an innocent young she's non-binary, so I don't know if it's correct to say a young woman, but just an innocent young person who got just caught up in an unfair law. Like it was very obviously that Russia tries to arrest specific people simply to arrest them and to terrorize them. So
yeah, and this idea of does the freedom of an innocent person justify, you know, the release of
a really evil criminal? Yeah, that's
it's an incredible difficult, like, of course one is inclined to say of course we want the innocent person in freedom, but it's all very, very difficult.
Especially since there is the fear and the very realistic assumption that Viktor Bout will go back to doing arms in Russia and will become even a more higher level political figure in the Putin regime, that Putin wanted him back for a long time.
Yeah, so and how much does the documentary focus on the injustice done to them versus this philosophical, you know, discussion?
Actually,
of
it's much more on of the injustice and Brittany Griner suffering in prison, and also her wife suffering at home, missing her, trying everything, campaigning and stuff to get her back home, because it took a whole lot of campaigning to get Biden and the US public to really say like we need this woman back. That's another tragic aspect, that many people get arrested innocently all over the world and they're just forgotten and they rot away in jail cells, and then there's maybe a few news stories and then the next thing happens and it's just forgotten, and that's terrible.
Yeah.
So absolute recommendation, very exciting, and I think it will get some international distribution or maybe on a streaming channel.
Yeah, that also does sound like a film that we might see next year at the awards campaign. That's the
best documentary and stuff, absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah, I want to plug another film, and this will be the last one perhaps for the festival from my side. We will see if we record another podcast episode, but in any case, that was the last film I saw. I just came out of it basically, and this is Makoto Nagahisa's Burn. Don't know anything about the director, didn't know anything about the film, and this is quite impressive. I will say, I cannot say that I enjoyed the movie. I don't know if it really comes together, but the sheer inventiveness of form at display is really quite something. This is basically a nihilistic pop sex worker story. I mean, it doesn't, you can see it's all very eclectic. It's all very bleak as well, at the same time as it is full of neon colors and really saturated colors. It's really hard to explain what this is, but we have a teenager. She's maybe, I don't know, she looks to me like 12, maybe 13, 14, and she's kind of a misfit. She was, since her earliest age, she has been beaten up by her father, and for 10 years or so she has prayed with her sister that her father dies. And what happens when her father dies? Well, the mom keeps on beating them. And this is basically the vicious cycle that is going on here. She also has a stammer, so she's stuttering the entire time, which is also why when she leaves home and when she flees home basically and joins a group of other misfits, she tries to say her name, but she cannot really get it together due to the stammer. And then she's just Juju, because those are the syllables that come out of her mouth at that moment. And this gets her into a cycle of sex work. She has this great idea that she wants to pile up 10 million yen, and 10 million yen apparently will then lead her to a better existence or something. That's her adolescent plan. She then finds a best friend with whom she teams up to do that together. And you can tell just from my description, this doesn't feel like a Sundance film in a way that you usually don't see teenage sex work and then see that play out as more like an anime or something. You know, it's very, very strange. It's a very strange movie. There are a lot of effects that I've never seen before. A lot of animations. There's so many different types of storytelling here. There's a voiceover narration, which later turns more into text narration. And sometimes the screen will fade to black and you just, for instance, we are told that she's taking a pill and then we just hear her taking the pill and it's all told in text when things get too bleak for her. It's, as you say, it's, I'm all over the place in my description, but just for the experience alone, I think I've never seen something quite like it, and that's why I would recommend this film, Burn by Makoto Nagahisa. Will you try to catch up with that one as well?
I think so, because you're not the only one who recommended it. Actually, a few very different people have recommended it to me, so I'm curious. Mm-hmm. And I still remember his first film, We Are Little Zombies, and even though I was back then, which is a long time
ago. Oh, I've heard of that film, yeah.
Yeah, it's more than 10 years ago. So back then I remember that I didn't like that film very much, but also even my taste can change in 10 years. And that I still remember that film also speaks to the originality of it, because no matter if you like it or not, you cannot say it's a film that you easily forget. And I appreciate it if people have their own style, their own handwriting in terms of direction, so I'm definitely curious on that one.
Yeah. And was that one also so out there? Like, was it also so daring formally? And
no, it was more, it had some interesting aspects. It was more like this little, there was also some parallels in the narrative. There was this little clique of kids mm-hmm. that wanted to break out of their family, repressive family frames, but it was on a lighter note. It was more a kid's film. It had a lot of musical sequences, so it partly felt like a pop or like a musical film. It was very, bright, colorful, loud, but not as interesting formally. It was a little bit playful formally, but not as daring as you described this one. So it seems that he really got more daring.
Okay. And what do you want to kick us home with?
Well, that's The Weight by Frederick McKinley. It's another one of those star-studded stories. We have Russell Crowe and Ethan Hawke in the lead roles in this historical drama in Oregon in the during the Great Depression. So it's the early 30s, and there's this main character called Samuel Murphy, the classical innocent guy who just gets mixed up, ends up in prison and in a working camp, and just hopes to go back to, he has a daughter, like he's a widower, and his daughter goes to an orphanage, and to get his daughter back before she gets adopted or becomes a ward of the state, he has to do a dirty deal with Russell Crowe's prison warden, and that involves moving like a load of gold through a rural area, through forest, through water, to smuggle it away. So, like, Russell Crowe wants to get the gold, and Murphy and a gang of his, like, a few fellow prisoners have to move the gold through the country area to some place where then Russell Crowe can pick it up safely. So it's the classical MacGuffin story, just mm-hmm. a group of people who's forced to go through rough territory and all kinds of dangers to accomplish something. And it's, I mean, this is a classical entertainment adventure story, with a lot of, it has much more humor than you would expect. That was for me very surprising, because I expected that would be like one of those hard masculinity stories. Mm-hmm. And then there are so many little jokes in it that it almost plays like a comedy at times. And it also tries to have a little bit of diversity, like we have an Indian character, then we have a Native American woman joining the group. Then one of the guys happens to be a communist, and one is from Scandinavia, another one is Irish. So you feel like that is still this early phase in the US when a lot of people were very conscious of their immigrant roots. And also this area, the Great Depression, when people just lost everything. Like, so many people back then lived in their cars. And this is something that's returning today. And I would have wished that these parallels historically would have been more emphasized.
Yeah.
But this film went much more into entertainment vein. So it's still a story of tough old white guys, mostly. And it's well done, it's well shot, great settings, it's well acted, you know, Ethan Hawke, Russell Crowe, they can just deliver. But it was also, it wasn't very deep acting. So the film is okay, I would give it like one thumb up, you know, you can watch it, but it's kind of forgettable. But since this has like more star power in it, I thought it's worth mentioning because it will definitely get a major release.
Mm. And yeah, I'm thinking of Aragon because there's certain filmmakers who use this again and again, right? We have the Deborah Granik film a few years ago. I forgot the title of the film, but where they are, where there's the father and
Winter's
her.
Bone?
Not Winter's Bone, but a few years later, because there was the...
I had a father-daughter story, yeah. Where they trekked to the forest and tried to escape the social system.
Capitalism, blah, blah, blah. Exactly, yeah, yeah. And then also Kelly Reichardt, right?
Yeah.
She returns there again and again. So is Aragon itself, does that become, I don't want to use the cliche like a character, but is that a major point of the story, that this is a specific kind of environment they are in there?
Yeah, I think they try to go somewhere like there, because they, for example, show like all the broken existences that just hang out there. Like we have luckless gold diggers still hanging out in the forest, then all the people who just ended up in this work camp and none of them has really done any conscious crime. It's more like people who got mixed up in the wrong things, like this communist guy who was just like protesting and then got arrested and got detained for a resisting arrest. So basically you get arrested for getting arrested. All those situations, and also the inner country migration, Dust Bowl migrants and all the stuff. So it's historically an interesting area, but it's more picturesque. So not as social critical as Reichardt and Granik.
Okay, and I think for just in case that this is our last episode here, we should perhaps highlight just two or three films that we think stood out for us, you know, so far. I mean, you are still staying here for a few days and have opportunity enough to find new little jewels and pearls, but for me, I'm done with the festival so far. I might still check out one or two online, but yeah. So I thought it would be nice to just perhaps highlight one or two or three films that throughout have been on the top of our list. For me, I think we talked about the film already. Once Upon a Time in Harlem was the standout. Really liked The Invite, that one that I talked about today. And I would also, up there, not quite, is the John Wilson film, The History of Concrete, and Josephine by Beth de Arocha was also quite interesting. So perhaps these films.
So I can definitely agree on Once Upon a Time in Harlem. This documentary is really historically important. My favorite film so far, it's still Buddy, that horror film. And last year, also all my favorite films were horror films. So I just go with that. And the documentary today about Brittany Griner, maybe it's because it's so fresh, but that also was really, really good and well worth seeing. So yeah, I'm still excited for a few films, for example, Thing, it's the family matinee. There's always just one family matinee film at Sundance, and this is a film, it's an adaptation of the eponymous children's book with Taika Waititi, but he just acts, he didn't direct.
Maybe this for the better.
Yeah, it's just, he's sometimes he's just better when he's only acting and not directing, and he can go too high wire. But about parents who just indulge their spoiled daughter, and when she wants a thing, like it's a children's way of saying thing, they just go to the jungle and then find some weird hairy thing, some kind of monster pet or whatever. So I'm curious how that turns out.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, there are certain things I wish I could have seen and experienced as well. I mean, tomorrow when I leave, there's the Richard Linklater live commentary of Nouvelle Vague, a film I didn't really like last year in Cannes, but nevertheless, I think these kind of live audio commentaries can be cool. There's this film, I think Is it called Cookie Queen or something like
Cookie that? Cookie Queens, yeah, yeah. A documentary about... Is it a documentary or is it a drama?
I thought it was a feature film, but I'm not
sure. It's possible. Because I remember it was about these little Girl Scouts who then bake cookies. Maybe it's also a feature film.
Yeah. That seemed nice and cute, so not gonna catch that one, but...
Yeah, there are very few kids' films here, and they are usually quite high quality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, do they even have a section here that
is...
No,
okay. They just have this family matinee, but this is one single screening.
Yeah.
Like, a film, not one single screening, but one single film that then has multiple screenings. And sometimes a film that's also nice for kids, like Cookie Queens, ends up in the selection. But it's not like in other festivals where they have like a dedicated or several dedicated kids film and young adult films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for me to summarize the festival as well, I think I wouldn't go quite as far as you to, you know, about the quality of the films here overall, but I do think I have seen many more films that I liked than I expected at the beginning. I think of the 15 films I saw, there are like 8 films or so that I would more or less recommend, and to me that's a very good quota, a very good percentage. So I go back quite positively from that festival, and I hope I can make it to Boulder that year.
Have been my next question. If you will try to get to Boulder next year, I will definitely try, and then maybe we meet again.
That'd be fun. And I'm sure in the meantime we see each other in Cannes at the very least.
Oh yeah, that is, of course, Cannes is already coming up.
Okay, so thank you so much, Lida, and bye-bye.
Bye.